we have this series, which is going to be a series of six shiurim, one shiur a month for the next 6 months. Hopefully, with the assistance of some of the other shuls in the neighborhood, I've been communicating with the last few days, that hopefully they'll come on board as well, so we can have a broader audience and maybe a change of the location. We can alternate locations. Hopefully, that'll be a good thing as well. Thank you very much.
I'm not used to starting on time, I have to tell you. It's like, what's wrong? But okay, we'll have to manage. This is a story I heard as a teenager. If you don't like the visual, change it. But the message is a constant. A giraffe meets an antelope on the plains. And they exchange niceties. Hello, how are you? How's the fodder? How's the foliage? And the giraffe asks the antelope how it feels to always have your head facing the ground. And the antelope says to the giraffe, well, that's where the food is. And the giraffe says to the antelope, but there's so much more to life than food. Like what? He says, well, there are things to see. There are things to hear. There are smells to appreciate, sounds, and all kinds of wonderful things. He says, really? To me, if I can't eat it, it doesn't serve a purpose. And the giraffe says, well, I must tell you that your life is very poor. Any person who can't get past the taste of smell, any animal, and I wonder what they're tasting when they're eating half-dry grass, but that's another story, is deficient. You're deprived of opportunity. Your senses are depressed. So the antelope says to the giraffe, well, why don't you convince me? If you think there's something beyond food, sell it to me. So the giraffe begins to describe a mountain and clouds and trees and little streams flowing out of the mountain, descending into the valley, gathering into a river, and flowing into a stream, and then into a river. He describes the landscape, nature. And the giraffe impresses upon the antelope how incredibly beautiful and meaningful it is. And the antelope says, you know, I'm not designed to raise my head, but I'll try. If you say it's that meaningful and that valuable and that wonderful, let me make an effort. And he tries to raise his head, but he's not designed to raise his head. He's designed to look at the ground and see the grass. And he raises his head, then it hurts his neck, and he gives up, and he tries again. To make a long story short, the giraffe convinces the antelope to raise its head. The antelope raises its head and says to the giraffe, so where are the clouds? He says, don't you see those white, puffy-looking things? Those are the clouds. And beneath them you have the mountain, and the trees, and the grass, and the little streams, and the river. And the antelope says, but I can't eat it. I can't eat it. One of the great issues in life is relevance. What we care about, what matters, what's important. You know, I teach teenage boys, young upstarts, you know, future rabbis. And they're very, very idealistic. They're very, very principled. But they're typical teenagers. They live in a black and white world. Everything's either perfect or terrible. And we talk about God and about religion and about Torah mitzvahs. And I tell them all the time, I said, God's biggest enemy is apathy. And they look at me, what does that mean? God's biggest problem is not the atheist, for various reasons, including the fact that there aren't that many of them. Plus, atheists are really closet believers. They're insistent that there isn't a God as a way of dealing with their God. It's, don't bother me. Don't waste my time. I'm not interested. I can't eat it. That's the issue. you know, my students will say things like, well, great intellectuals, great scientists, and great thinkers, why not interested, you know, in Hasidic philosophy? It's so wonderful and so meaningful and so intellectual. So I try to impress upon them, it's not like they don't find it stimulating or they disagree. That may be the case also. They simply couldn't be bothered. They're busy. They have another life. The topic of tonight's class is the neshama, the soul. The Jewish soul, the godly soul, as it's called in the Tanya. Chassidus doesn't have a monopoly on the soul. For those who do not know, the soul is in the Bible, the very first page. The soul is not an invention of Kabbalah or philosophy or Medrash. In the very beginning of the Chumash, the description of the creation of man and woman, and God Almighty blows into his nostrils the breath of life. This is the first time the soul is introduced. So the soul is not novel to Chassidus and to Kabbalah. What is novel about the soul and the centricity of the soul and the discussion of the soul and being involved in the whole business of a spiritual self or even a godly / spiritual self is the relevance. What you have in Chassidus that is interesting is that Chassidus says the soul is not just an idea. There are many ideas. The soul is a real thing which is a real part of ourselves that we have a real relationship with, a real use for, and we should figure out what it means and how to employ it, how to translate it, how to make it work for us, so to speak, in our lives as human beings and certainly in our lives as spiritual and religious people. And that's the challenge. When you teach Hasidic philosophy, the ideas are beautiful, if you're interested. If not interested, they're also beautiful. The issue when it comes to mysticism and philosophy is making it relevant. And that's our topic. Okay, every Jew believes, or many Jews believe, that there's a concept of a soul. You know, but as some would say, you know, may you rest in peace. The soul is finding how to make a living. I have to feed my family, have things to worry about, I have to plan a vacation. So we say that deep inside a human being there's a life force that's living. For those who want to understand the technicalities of what I just said, the fundamental, the simplest definition of a soul is the argument that says biology is not only biology. You know, we live in a scientific age, there's no question about it. And the understanding of life at the moment in the mainstream of the study of life is that life is simply chemicals organized in a very sophisticated way. And that life comes from biomass, from physical pieces that are glued together in the right order to create, living responses, neurological responses and so forth. Spiritual teachings, Torah, Hasidus, Kabbalah teach that if something is alive, the biomass, the biological construction, is only the vessel. The fact that it's living is there's something which is not at all biological, it's not at all physical. You can't explain it as a physical entity or as a chemical entity or as a biological entity. It's a spiritual thing. It's non-physical that fuses, that joins with the physical being, be it human being, animal, or plant, to make it alive. That's really the most technical definition of a soul. It's the belief that life is beyond just physiology. And in the current world, it's not even a big debate. You know, the ancient philosophers, including the very secular ones, took that for granted, that if something is living, it has a soul, and the soul is not just the composite, the organization, the convergence of the different physical parts that create a form that is conducive to living. But we're not just talking about life. We're talking about a godly soul, a Jewish soul, a soul with a purpose, with a definition. What the Tanya calls a part of God, that relationship with God. And many a person will say to you, soul is a great concept. It is a great concept. beautiful concept. But what relevance does it have to me? I'll share with you a personal idea, a personal thought, which I'm sure many could relate to, but I'm sharing with you because it's an experience I had. My wife and I had a very, very sick child with a neurological disease. It's many, many years ago. You don't have to feel bad for me anymore, okay? It's all good. It's wonderful. I didn't talk about it when I was hurting. And he suffered terribly. He had a very short life, a very miserable life. The details are not important. If you're interested, I'll tell you in private. And he died. And part of the process of dealing with that is identifying the fact he was a physical human being that God Almighty created, and almost from the moment of his birth, the life was very, very difficult for him. And when he passed away, the soul became everything. And what was the comfort? In other words, how did we experience it at that time? The soul is perfect. The illness, the disease is not in the soul, the illness is in the body. The soul is peaceful. The soul has joy. The soul has energy. Now, for whatever reason, these are God's affairs. We don't ask questions, let's be honest with you. We don't ask such questions. We deal with such situations. God wanted this child to come into this world. He did what he had to do. We did what we needed to do. He's perfect. He's at peace. And he's alive. You know, when a person passes away, the basic religious belief is the body dies. The soul lives on. Any imperfection, any deficiency, any fault, any flaw, any weakness is a product of the body. And as much as the soul is concerned, there's a perfection. And one of the ideas, which is very meaningful to me personally, is the idea that the soul is full of joy and energy. And I'll tell you how I mean that. We deal with a phenomena called laziness. You ever heard of laziness? Anybody know anybody who has a lazy bone? Never. <yeah. laughs> Physiologists call it the law of osmosis. If I can sit on a couch, why would I stand up? It takes less energy to lay than to sit, and takes less energy to sit than to stand. The soul doesn't have a lazy bone. The whole notion of heaviness, the whole notion of lethargy, of drag, is a physical property. It's an expression of the real world, what we define as the real world. The soul is beyond all those things. So I remember when my son passed away, we went through this process. I'm not going to make us sound like these very sophisticated mourners. We weren't. We had little kids and we were busy. But nevertheless, the idea was that here was this little boy, his name was Menachem, had such a hard, difficult time, but he lives, and now it's good. He still lives. He's perfect. He's at peace. And to me, the idea that a soul outside of body is full of energy, it's just very driven and very focused and very joyous. Joyous is a funny kind of word to say about a being that's not connected to the world we live in. But what joy means, and I'm going to share with you a little later this evening, that he has a focus. And he doesn't have ADD, you understand? They have no Ritalin on the other side. Because they don't have the issues that create the need for these kind of compensation methods. But the question to us is, okay, that's a great philosophy, it's a great theology perhaps. What does it mean to me? Why is the soul of practical value, of practical use to me? So let me give you a little piece of history, just a short little discussion. This is a perspective, this is my opinion, okay? I'm not a historian, I don't teach history, but just from a very, very simplistic perspective, I would say the Jewish theology evolved in three stages. Somebody else would give a different division, and I wouldn't argue with them, but just for the purposes of tonight, there was Jewish philosophy, then there was Jewish mysticism, and then there was Hasidus. To me, they're an evolution. Jewish philosophy is very, very much consistent with secular philosophies, analyzing things with pure rationalization, pure reason. Kabbalah, Jewish mysticism, which historically happened later, is very different. It's a mysticism, which means to say, in order to understand Kabbalah, you have to accept certain axioms. You have to assume certain things that you cannot prove, like a soul, for example. Kabbalah, mysticism, which they is, it's, you know, you want to get a crowd, just hang up a sign Kabbalah, people will come running. it just draws people in. Kabbalah, for a very, very long time, was a secret society. Kabbalah was not something that was just out there for the masses. And there's a very important reason why. Many people study Kabbalah, many people are stimulated by Kabbalah. But the ideal use of Kabbalah, in other words, if you'll ask a Kabbalist what Kabbalah was supposed to be, Kabbalah was supposed to be a lifestyle and an exercise of accessing the godly soul. Kabbalah in its true form, in its ideal form, is not a philosophy or a stimulus. It is a lifestyle that brings a person in touch with his or her inner self, with his or her godly point. Now, all of us understand that to succeed at reaching the inner person, you have to be very committed. In other words, Kabbalists are not a dime a dozen. True Kabbalists, people who didn't just study it but lived it, were very unusual people. They were, as a rule, quite intelligent, very, very informed, well-schooled in other areas of Torah, and the study of Kabbalah to them was a means of self-refinement. It wasn't just an intellectual exercise. It was an exercise of literally getting closer to God. Or said a little bit differently, getting closer to the God within themselves, their own God, their own godly point. And, you know, what separates, what is it, the girls from the women, is, or the women from the girls, is whether you study Kabbalah or you practice Kabbalah. Whether you study the ideas or you do the exercises necessary for your soul, for your spiritual inside to emerge and come to the surface. And it's not for the faint of heart, let's just put it that way. So Kabbalah was a secret society because its appeal was narrow. The way the ideal study of Kabbalah is described essentially is, first be perfect, then we'll have a conversation. That's how it used to be. I mean, you may have read the disclaimers. You know, many Kabbalah books have on the first page written in Hebrew, it says, until you're 40 and you've done this, this, and this, and this, close the book. They've taken it out of the later prints for some reason. But Kabbalah is a spiritual way of life. In other words, it's a form of Judaism that is about accessing the inner self. It's about accessing the soul. But it's a very exclusive. It speaks to a very narrow, to a very an ideal group of people, a very, very special group of people. And I just want to say, give you one insight, okay? There's a concept called divine inspiration, Ruach HaKodesh. On the highest levels, we call it prophecy. What does divine inspiration mean? What does divine inspiration sound, feel like? To many, divine inspiration is, you know, God wants to tell you something. If you're tuned in, if you're on the right frequency, here's what you say. But in fact, divine inspiration is something much, much more subtle than that. God is everywhere. God is everything. When a human being sensitizes himself, they're tuned in. They sense God. When a human being is in a condition of great personal refinement, they're tuned in. You know, the Rebbe was a very interesting man. How many of you have met the Rebbe? Unfortunately, I have to ask the question, but the Rebbe was a very unusual human being, because if you knew anything about him, you knew that this human being had incredibly unusual special powers. I mean, he knew things that there was no way he should have known. However you explain it, but people came to him with problems and he resolved them in ways that cannot be explained naturally. It was a miracle worker, there's no doubt about it, and on an incredible scale. But he was very, very humble. It was like, I didn't do it. I don't know what you're talking about. Really, that happens? A nice story. He always had a way of blaming on somebody else or something else. So somebody, an interviewer, once asked the Rebbe very pointedly, that they say you're a prophet. So the Rebbe would interrupt and say, I'm not a prophet. I have special powers. The word prophet made him very nervous. I have special powers. So this person said to the Rebbe, where did you get these special powers from? And his answer was very simple. Everybody has special powers. You have to simply allow them to emerge. Now, simply allowing them to emerge isn't simple. Because if it was, life would be interesting. And there'd be other challenges. But that's really what Kabbalah is, honestly. Kabbalah is honestly people who are tuned into their special powers because they've created a lifestyle for themselves that sensitizes them to that access. I wrote down three words on my piece of paper. Humility, joy, and connection. I wrote in Hebrew. Anova, simcha, tvekas. Kabbalists were... If you're busy with yourself, there's not only no space for anybody else, there isn't space for God either. Even if your ego is, you know, your knowledge of God's wisdom, even if your ego is about how religious you are, nothing frightens God away more than an arrogant, than a self-consumed human being. Spiritual people are, first of all, humble. They have an inner joy, an inner peace, which if you want to explain that psychologically means they accept their life as it is, which is a very interesting trick, and it's very useful. It's just not so easy. And they have a capacity to attach themselves to things that are not necessarily the material. Chassidus is a very interesting idea. It really is an interesting idea. Because what the Baal Shem Tov wanted to do was make the whole notion of spiritual Judaism available to everybody. In a nutshell, that's how I see it. The Baal Shem Tov did not come into this world to help rabbis become greater rabbis. He may have done that. You know, the Baal Shem Tov had a following of extraordinary scholars and pious people who sat at his table and, you know, drank from his water, so to speak. But he wasn't born for that purpose. He was born to introduce the notion that the spiritual side of Judaism, and for lack of words, let's call it Kabbalah. I don't like the word Kabbalah, but let's call it Kabbalah, should somehow find a way to the ordinary person, to the simple person, and to the inexact person. In other words, Chassidus really is about making the soul relevant to people who don't define themselves as very spiritual, who don't define themselves as people whose entire identity is refinement and cleansing and self-perfection and scholarship and a cleaving to God, and then the reward for that is some kind of a spiritual sense. And this is how I appreciate Chassidus. This is why I understand what Chassidus is. It is making real spirituality, and real spirituality is only one thing. What's inside us, superimposed spirituality is propaganda, accessible to the common person. So what in mysticism, what in Kabbalah is the property of a few, and Hasidic philosophy becomes the property of the masses. In other words, somehow, if you study Hasidus, if you study Tanya, and Tanya is a great book to study, it really is. It's truly a classic work. There are a few words in the English language that have been more abused than the word classic, but Tanya is a classic work. The effect of these, of learning these things and taking these things seriously, is they suggest to you the idea that I too am a spiritual person, and I have a spiritual side, and that I can have a real sense of my own spirituality. In other words, I can be in touch with, or somehow, or to some degree, or in some kind of way, in quotes, reveal the inner me, the inner Jew, the spiritual Jew that's naturally one with God. Now, of course, if the Baal Shem Tov was trying to take an exclusive philosophy and make it available to the masses, he had to make major adaptations, right? If my postulation is true, that Kabbalah is a mysticism that teaches special people how to access their spiritual self, and along comes Chassidus and says, okay, let's make this available to everybody. There's got to be a few new tricks. And Chassidus does have a few new tricks. And I'll share them with you in brief. This is not a topic for tonight, but I just want to mention them. What are the, you know, the classic Hasidic tools that make the notion of spirituality relevant? I would say the most important, bar none, the most important is the connection between the common person and the holy man, and the tzaddik, and the righteous man, the master. Chassidus is a movement that very much is centered on the leader. And not so much because the leader is intelligent and scholarly, but because the leader is spiritual and closer to God. Chassidus is quite diverse. In other words, the Baal Shem Tov founded a movement that over the course of, let's say, 50 years or 75 years, diversified. It split apart, not only into different movements, but in different philosophies. Chassidus is quite, you know, you can pick and choose. Chassidus is not, you know, the same idea with a different uniform. You know, it may be the same uniform with a different idea. There's a lot of variety to how Chassidus is expressed, but at the heart of it is the relationship between the common person and the tzaddik. The idea is that when you're close to a holy person, you become a little holier. To use a very simple idea, in many Hasidic cultures, I will put it to you this way. I was born in Crown Heights. Okay, I spent almost all of my life in Crown Heights, and I'm functional. Fine. There's nothing wrong with me. But when I was a child, in the early 70s, Crown Heights was a very diverse community. It was a frum community, an Orthodox community, but very diverse. All of the Europeans who came here after the war settled in Crown Heights. So you had a gamut, you had a cross-section. It was a smorgasbord of Jewish options. Every shul was a little different. The shuls were built grassroots. People came in from Europe with nothing and built little communities, little shtiblach that conformed to their particular tradition, their particular culture. And you had an incredible variety of different shtiblach. Unfortunately, as the neighborhood changed, there was a mass exodus. And all that's left in Crown Heights is Lubavitch. Unfortunately, I think we're poorer for it. You know, I had an experience that my children can't have. But I remember this as a child. A group of old survivors, Alte Yidden, to me they were ancient. They were probably 50, but to me they could have been 80 or 90, you know. They came to Shul 6 in the morning. They went to a mikveh that was so hot I couldn't get my foot into it. And they davened, you know, they were speed readers. The davening lasted, whatever it was, 15 minutes and 16 minutes on Monday and Thursday. They davened very, very quickly. And they went to work. But the front of the shul was a little room with a little box of cake that was so hard that even I didn't want to eat it. And a tiny little bottle of schnapps. And invariably, these who were to me old-timers would walk into the front room and they'd fill up these little cups with schnapps. They put the cake on the plate, which nobody touched, went back into the box to get out the next day. After Pesach, there was fresh cake. This is almost, I mean, I remember trying to steal that cake. I said, you know what, you can keep it. They'd fill their schnapps glasses, and someone would say, today is the yahrzeit of such and such a tzaddik. Like, for example, yesterday, Gimel happened to be the yahrzeit of the Holy Yubisol of Ruzhin. And someone would say, no, tomorrow is the yahrzeit. And that was it. They were off. They were in an argument that they could have missed their work. But then someone would tell a story, and someone would say, no, you got the story wrong. And in 10 minutes, something would happen. As a child, I saw them as a bunch of angry old men, honestly. But in hindsight, I realized those 10 minutes, that was their life. You know, they grew up in Europe. In Europe, they had payas and big beards. Now all of them were clean-shaven. Their children put back on the shtreimels and the payas and the beards. A lot of them, after they retired, and their children were all wearing shtreimels, would allow themselves a little beard or a hat. But this is, you know, life going full circle. But in the old country, that's what people did. They told stories about tzaddikim, current and past. Because what are the thread that all these stories have in common? Miracles, for the most part. They didn't really tell stories about the piety and the depth and the sincerity of these people. That's really more of a Chabad tradition, to be candid. They just told stories about their capacity at performing miracles. And some people say, what are you wasting your time? You know, learn Gemara, do something useful. But what they got from those stories was a sense that God is real. That's what they got from those stories. That's what Hasidim get, you know, from traveling to Uman, for example. I don't want to give you any ideas, but that's what people do. Traveling to the Ukraine and you visit all the holy sites. That's what they get. They're connected to a life which is not their own. It's on a higher plane, and it raises them up. And that's, I believe, the most basic technique or method of how Hasidus is effective, and it makes ordinary persons, people, in touch with spirituality by connecting them to extraordinary people. That relationship is very, very, very important. Incredibly, incredibly important. And today, many people are finding that by the oil, you know, by the tzid. You know, people go to Mezhebush, to the Baal Shem Tov, and there's something real that occurs. I can't stop myself from digressing. This is a great story. True. One of the greatest Hasidic masters of all was Yiddish, the Rebbe of Melech, Rebbe the Melech of Luzhensk. He passed away in 1786. Okay? It's been a while, yeah? 1786. He was an incredibly holy man. He was also one of the greatest Hasidic leaders. He produced some of the greatest Hasidic masters of the next generation. All the great Hasidic Rebbes of Poland were his disciples. And I think he said something to the effect that if you visit my grave, I'll help you. Now, of course, for all these years, nobody could visit Europe, Eastern Europe. But when communism fell, you know, there are a lot of travel agents making a nice living on the back of Hasidus. And more power to them. I have no problem with it. And the people make a special pilgrimage to the Rebbe of Melech. His yartzeit is sometime in Adar. And people appear in the yartzeit and they claim that all kinds of wonderful things happen. An Israeli travel agent, a Hasidic fellow, has a modern Israeli friend who was childless. And he says, listen, in such and such a date as the yartzeit of the Rebbe of Melech, I'm planning to go to his gravesite in Luzhensk, which is a small shtetl someplace in Eastern Europe. Join me. You want children? Come, let's pray at his grave. He said, listen, I don't have the time and I can't afford it and this doesn't... I don't know why, but this travel agent said, I'll pay your traveling expenses. Come with me. It's very difficult to turn that down. So he agreed. And they traveled to Luzhensk. And he says, two conditions. If you have a son, you're going to name him Elimelech, which is the name of the Rebbe of Elimelech. And I want to be Sandik. Anyway, they traveled to Luzhensk. They were mishtateach. They prayed by the grave of Elimelech. Guess what? His wife became his child. And then he broke the news to her that their child's name is going to be Elimelech. And she says, oh my God, what kind of Israeli name is that? So there was a whole new politic. And as it came closer to the time of the delivery, this travel agent said, remember, I'm the Sandik and his name is Elimelech. He says, you can be the Sandik, but I don't know about the name. And it was a very big deal. I mean, which Israeli girl wants a name like Elimelech? Far too many syllables. Anyway, it was agreed in the end that she would choose a second name. In other words, his name would be Elimelech plus an Israeli name, like Dror, or something really, really, you know, hip. So she chose the name Noam. Noam. His name is Noam Elimelech. What she doesn't know is that the book that Rebbe Elimelech authored is called Noam Elimelech. So she got what she didn't want. Anyway, getting back to the point, there are many techniques that are part of the Hasidic tradition. You know, the singing, the dancing, the festivities. All of these things, they have a lot of meaning. And at the heart of it is, the meaning of the entire lifestyle of Hasidus is to take ordinary people and help them be a little bit more spiritual, be a little bit more in touch with their soul. But I want to discuss with you what the Tanya has to say about this. And in the Tanya, there are a variety of different examples or points that all argue the relevance of the soul, the relevance of the soul. And the first is knowing that you have a soul means you should know you're special. Now, understand the context. You should know you're special means expect a lot of yourself. Not I'm wonderful, but if I'm special, I've got to earn my specialness. It's one of the most important messages in all the Tanya. And I'll tell you this idea using an example that I had. I think it was 1991. 1991 is not the 17th century. Okay, 1991 is the modern world. A group of Israeli soldiers finished their stint in the army and they traveled east, which is, of course, what they all do. Like, they'll never speak to Lubavitch in Israel, but in India, they love Lubavitch. That's how it works. My nephew is a shliach in Cambodia. Heaven's sakes, where's Cambodia? Who lives in Cambodia? Israeli backpacker. That's what lives in Cambodia. It's incredible. It's incredible. The self-sacrifice is mind-blowing, but that's my nephew and my niece. They traveled east, and they were in a Muslim country. I forgot which one it is. I wrote down Indonesia because it's probably Indonesia, but I don't remember which one it was. Five Israeli boys. One of them was Dati, was modern Orthodox, if you will. The others were not religious at all, and there was one or two who were very outspokenly Shomer HaTzair, very secular. They didn't believe in anything. And of course, they were buddies. They spent 3 years together in the army, and they argued about religion. What else did they talk about, right? Politics is boring in Israel. Okay. Anyway, somehow it was discovered that they're Israelis, and they were arrested. And when it was determined that they were soldiers, they were accused of being spies. It was in the paper. I read it in the New York Times. They were going to be executed.
How long
was it? 1991. This happened in our lifetime. Not, you know. But they were soldiers. They weren't yeshiva bachim. So they put up a fight. The story, as I recall it, is twice they escaped. Twice they jumped their captors. There was a firefight and they escaped. Unfortunately, they didn't all survive. Only one or two survived. But they fought. And what was interesting about it was that the captors proposed to them that if they would become Muslims, they'd let them live. Now, what's the big deal to become a Muslim if you don't believe in any God? I mean, what does it cost you? Well, water. What's the program of becoming a Muslim? They tell you in a mikveh, they give you fish. What, I don't know what it, but what does it cost? And the five of them unanimously said, there's nothing to discuss. The religious one who survived was interviewed. I don't understand. I sat with this guy for 3 years and all he talked about how there isn't a God. And now he's who knows where. His life is on the line, and unhesitantly, without hesitating, he says, you can kill me. I'm not going to convert to Islam. So I was a new teacher at the time. I was teaching teenage boys. And I came across the part of the Tanya that talks about this. There's a section in the Tanya that discusses the idea that within each Jew, there's such a powerful connection to God that if, God forbid, the opportunity arose, we would die to remain Jewish. It's a very powerful part of the Tanya, very powerful part of the Tanya, that we don't know how Jewish we ourselves are. And we all hope we never find out. But when a Jew is squeezed, it really doesn't matter how religious they have been in the course of their lifetime. Something incredibly potent, incredibly genuine emerges, and you're prepared to die for this. So I'm teaching it to my teenage boys, and I had in my class that time a delinquent, a true illegal delinquent. He was a real, real troublemaker. The good news was he almost never came to class. But he happened to be there on that day. And he was interested in what I was teaching, like I was interested in what he was stealing. But I, for some reason, I remember the day. I remember the day very distinctly because something very powerful happened that day. Someone very important died. And we got to Olavaya. We had a very, very big classroom. And I had seven. It was a very small group of kids. And he was listening. And I'm having this conversation. And he got out of his seat. He was not more than 16. And ran around the room like a caged animal. He says, Rabbi, I think you're out of your mind. He says, well, he gives me a cross and a sword. I'll kiss the cross in a moment. Well, am I nuts? What's the big deal? And he was so angry. He was so angry. His anger itself revealed something. In other words, his anger almost revealed like he was trying to protect himself from what he somehow inherently knew had some credibility. So I told him the story. It was... This happened at the end of 1992, and the story was a year and a half old, 2 years old. See, yeah, they died 500 years ago when they were stupid. In the modern world, nobody. I told him the story, and he was completely taken aback. So the Alter Rebbe in the Tanya makes a proposal. And the proposal is very simple. You think the martyrs of yesteryear were any more Jewish than we are? They weren't. They were simply tested. The message is, he says, each of us should recognize that that potential exists within us. Deeply embedded within us is an incredible attachment to God, a will, an urgency, a purpose, an integrity, a single-mindedness, which is incredibly powerful. Fortunately, and thank God, you know, I go around telling people all the time, the best time to be alive is right now, and they look at me like I'm a fool. And I look at them like they're pathetic. It is the best time to be alive, certainly for Jewish people. When the Jews have it better? We got problems, life's not perfect, but come on. But the result of the incredible comfort and ease and relative peace and security with which we live our lives quiets those voices. That inner potency, that inner energy, that inner power is not stimulated. There's nothing sharp enough, there's nothing intense enough to bring out that inner power. So the Alter Rebbe makes a proposal. Why wait? Challenge yourself. In other words, when you study Chassidus, and Chassidus tells you every Jew is precious, guess what? That means you too. That means me also. And just as you look at another Jew and you say, you know, I have no idea. You never know what another human being is about. Guess what? You don't know what you yourself are about. Don't cut yourself short. So, this becomes a practical instruction. When we tell ourselves, I can't. When we tell ourselves, this is too difficult, this is too consuming, this is too involved, this is too religious, this is too, you know, what's the dirty word? Ultra. It isn't. It isn't. We know why it isn't. Because you're more Jewish than you admit to yourself. And the Alter Rebbe says to every person, challenge yourself. Challenge yourself to permit yourself to be more Jewish, because you'll always really be more Jewish than you're actually being. The story goes that the Holy Baal Shem Tov was sitting in his little office, little room, and it was in the middle of the night, and his disciples were sitting around, farbrenging, doing something useful. And it was cold, there was snow outside, and there was a big wind, and the door opens and in walks a coachman with frozen icicles all over his face, all bundled up. His complexion is tomato red, and he's very, very upset. He says, my horse fell into a ditch and the wagon fell on top of the horse. In a matter of hours, he's going to suffocate. I need to drag this wagon out of the pit so I can save my horse. Help me! What do we know about horses? You want to know if it's kosher today? If we can tell you? You want to know about the soul? We can help you. We're not trained in the exercise of pulling horses out of ditches. So he left. And he went to a tavern, went to look for people who were tough enough to help him schlep his horse out of the ditch. But it was very late at night. Everyone was asleep. So he comes back into the shtiebel and says, I know you're not experts, but as they say in the horse world, it's a matter of life and death. I need your help. And they tell him, we can't. So he angrily says to them in Russian, Mudget, tinechotchet. Now, I'm sure I ruined the accent terribly, but I hope you don't mind. It means basically, you can. You don't want to. So the Baal Shem Tov is sitting in the other room and he hears somebody roaring in Ukrainian. If you wanted to, you could. You're just not interested. The Baal Shem Tov came out and said, don't you understand that those are the words of God? That's the message God tells us all the time. You can, you don't want to. And the Alter Rebbe says, knowing how Jewish we are is a constant challenge. Allow more of what we are inside to emerge. I'll give it to you from another point of view. One of the core teachings of Chassidus is love a fellow Jew. Ahavas Yisrael. It's at the very heart of Chassidus. Perhaps we'll get to it on a different occasion. Why are you supposed to love another Jew? Because a Jew is very special. What makes a Jew so special? The answer is, he has a Jewish soul. So it's a beautiful idea. You know, the Hasidic movement has at its heart the idea of loving another person and really not judging. Honestly not judging. Not just saying you don't judge and then judging anyway. Truly accepting people for what they are, helping people along, but really, that's not funny, it's true, really not judging people, accepting people and so on. So the Tanya says, guess what? The mitzvah of loving a fellow Jew extends to yourself with an asterisk. That when it comes to yourself, you're qualified to judge. When it comes to everybody else, you have to accept because you don't know the story. When it comes to yourself, you do. So there's one insight into how Hasidus says the soul doesn't only exist, it speaks to you practically. Let me move on to another idea. The idea of joy. What do we know about joy? What do we know about joy? When we were teenagers, we were all joyous. Now, we wish we were teenagers. Or we wish our teenagers would grow up, or some kind of a combination. What do we know about joy? Joy is a very interesting concept. I knew a Jew who lives in Jerusalem. His name is Gil Lux. If you visited Jerusalem, you met him. I promise you met him. He's a real character. When I knew him in L.A. 30 years ago, he lived in this little van that was decorated in every imaginable color, and he traveled the length and breadth of the state putting on mezuzahs. He must have put up thousands of mezuzahs. He's a mezuzah. Very interesting Jew. In the 70s, he had been a guru. He had a little cult, and people mamish worshipped him. See, he told me once, I was 14 or 15. I was very little. He said, this is 1981, a man once paid me $40,000. I should teach him how to be happy. In other words, like a person paying someone today $100,000 to teach him how to be happy. I was staggered. I was just floored. And I think I said to him, so what did you say? I don't think he answered me. And maybe he did, but it went straight over my head. There's something very compelling about that. Joy is elusive. Joy is not so simple. It's not so easy. And the simple argument of Hasidus is joy is innate. You don't have to make yourself joyous. You have to permit it to emerge. Because joy is a symptom of the soul. And it's very, very much a part of the Hasidic way of life. And the Hasidic philosophy is find within yourself joy. There's a Gemara. What is a Gemara? The Talmud says that one of the great rabbis met Elijah the prophet. And he said to him, can you show me someone who has earned a place in the world to come? So show me somebody who's earned his place in the world to come. So he showed him two comedians. Two comedians. They weren't rabbis. They just made people laugh. That's very interesting. That the Gemara says, Hanitrei Batchoi, people who bring joy, optimism to people, you earn your way into the world to come. Joy is a very serious spiritual truth. There was a Yidele who survived the war, Polish Jew, came to America, never got married, and he hung around. He hung around 770, hung around Crown Heights. He had an interesting relationship with the Rebbe. He was really a nomadic Jew. He went to every kind of Rebbe, to every kind of Hasidus. He made the rounds. Everybody was his friend. He had a very unusual relationship with the Rebbe. So in the middle 70s, the Rebbe was already so busy that he was almost on a pedestal, you know. The Rebbe I knew, I'm only in my mid-40s, the Rebbe I knew was unavailable. The Rebbe my father knew was a father. You know, as Lubavitch expanded, the Rebbe once publicly lamented the fact that, you know, because he's becoming more successful, he has less connection to the people he's involved with. But this fellow, in the 1970s, when the Rebbe was really not so easy to reach, walked into the Rebbe's room and he said to the Rebbe, in effect, how are you? Was machste? You know, people don't usually ask the Rebbe, how you doing? So the Rebbe, without hesitating, said, Ich bin tamid besimcha. I'm always joyous. But I want to qualify that. When the Rebbe turned 80, a Lubavitcher poet, whose name was Mr. Steinmetz, he has since passed away, wrote a poem. Beautiful poem in Hebrew. He wrote beautiful Hebrew poetry to celebrate the Rebbe's 80th birthday. And he gave it to the Rebbe as a gift. in that poem, he describes his sense of the Rebbe by contrasts, extremes. Like, for example, he has his head in the clouds and his feet are planted firmly on the ground. These kind of dichotomies. And one of the things he writes in that poem is, he hears everybody's tzaddis. And that's the truth. I mean, you know, when did you need the Lubavitcher Rebbe? When life was bad. Life was good, who's got time for it? The Rebbe used to call them tzaddis chassidim. You know, the chassidim and their tzaddis. He says, everybody dumped on the Rebbe all their problems. And his resource of joy was inexhaustible. He writes it in Hebrew. Al-kein ma'yam simchato lo yechazev. His fountain of joy is inexhaustible. So the Rebbe picked up the poem and he read it. And he looked at him and said, halavai. It ain't so easy. It's not as easy as it looks. The thing that we must understand about joy is that joy is not a result of life. It's a cause for life. Pleasure is a result of life. Happiness, I don't know where to put happiness. It's like in between. Joy is an attitude. And the attitude energizes. The attitude of joy empowers a person. The problem is, it's hard. It's hard because life constantly challenges that tendency. You know, optimism is a great idea. It's just not a practical one. And Hasidus' argument is that as impractical as optimism is, the alternative is self-destructive, is not an option. So you're constantly, essentially, you're going against the current. Just stay up, be positive. A joyous person is a Hasidic person. A joyous person is a living person. A joyous person is a motivated person. And yes, a joyous person will be a successful person. And one of the most basic expressions of the soul about which the Tanya speaks is the need to access, utilize joy. In other words, the argument is you don't have to make yourself joyous. The joy exists inside. Permit it, its emergence. Allow it to come out. And let me explain it to you. What is the source of joy? Either being a fool. If you're a fool, you're not worried about anything, so you can afford to be very, very happy. Or trust. Trust. The nature of the world in which we live is, if something bad could happen, it will happen, right? That's the rule. That's what they say. No one knows who they are, but you don't want to question them, because they may come after you. The rule, this is the tendency, right? There is not a pessimist on the planet who calls himself a pessimist. Every pessimist calls himself a realist. And you know what? He may very well be. He may very well be. Joy is saying, I believe in goodness. Joy is really saying, the idea that this world is God's, and that God, this world belongs to God not just because He created it, but because He controls it. He's proactively involved in my life, gives me security. It allows me to sleep at night. What a concept. Right? We sleep at night when our job is secure. How secure is our job? Incredibly secure. Let's not even discuss it. Yisro betach b'Hashem. Ultimately, what do you trust? What do you trust? You trust that this floor is going to be here for the next, whatever, 15 minutes. I don't know how much longer my talk is going on. As long as I stand here, the floor is going to be here. Oh, yeah? Well, I trust the terra firma. Below this floor, there are beams. And below these beams, I guess there's a basement. But below the basement, there's earth. And the earth is not going to move. I trust that the earth will be there. Oh, yeah? What do you trust? What's permanent? God is permanent. And the permanence of God is not just a philosophy. The permanence of God is a way of life. The permanence of God is currency, is real. And the currency of the permanence of God is, therefore, I'm not afraid. I'm not stupid. I'm not blind. I'm not naive. But I trust. That's the source. It's the ultimate source of joy. It's the ultimate source of optimism. So the Tanya says to each person, you have the capacity for joy. In other words, you have the capacity for the trust which will elicit, which will bring forward the necessary joy. Permit it to come out. And there's a very, very interesting psychological challenge presented in the Tanya. I teach this to teenagers and I make them memorize it because I think these quotes are million-dollar quotes. I'll just tell you the Hebrew, translate them, and then I'll put it in context. One of the quotes is, Teker nafshe be'enov, lismoyach besimchosa, yoise miguf hanivze. Your soul should be precious enough to you to rejoice in its joy rather than the shameful body. That's one quote. Another quote, this is my favorite. Shalayla arve v'levalbel simchas hanefesh b'yitzavin haguf. Don't entangle and confuse the joy of the soul and the sadness of the body. And the third is the clincher. Ach ani lo yasisi esatzmi. I didn't create myself. I didn't create my limitations. I didn't create my obstructions. I got to live. The spirit of this challenge is every human being, what is the expression? You can always look at the cup as half full and half empty. And it's always true. It really is always true. You want to find something wrong, there's plenty to find wrong. But if you want to be an optimist, there's plenty to be optimistic about. Alter Rebbe says every human being is always on a threshold. The threshold of realism or optimism. And he says, do yourself a favor. Celebrate your soul. Be an optimist. Be joyous. It's a practical manifestation of the inner human being. It's a practical manifestation of the Jewish soul. I really mean that. I mean, I'm not a great expert, but this is very real to me. I'm not just a lecturer. This is a personal experience. Joy is an incredible weapon. And depression is a terrible state of defeatism. It's difficult. It's a challenge. You see, you don't need a reason to be joyous. You need joy so you can live. But joy is a challenge. And the Tanya says, you don't have to create it. You have to permit it to emerge. It's on the inside. That's a second example. A third is love of a fellow man, love of a fellow Jew. Also an important argument made in the Tanya. How are you supposed to love somebody else? Because you love yourself. And that person gave you breakfast, so you love him, right? Isn't that the truth? I love you because you and I have this or that in common, because you've done this favor for me. But the moment the situation changes, my love dissipates. In other words, I love only me and anybody else who serves my purposes. That's reality. But that's not Tanya. It's not Judaism. It's not Hasidus. Love thy fellow as thyself doesn't come with an asterisk. How are you supposed to love somebody else? A story. There's a great Hasidic master, and I apologize for not remembering his name, who lost a child on Shabbos. On the Sabbath, one of his children died. And according to Jewish law, on the Sabbath, you're not allowed to mourn, right? Very easy to say. But a tzaddik, a holy person, you know, follows the rules. I mean, I remember when the Rebbe lost his wife, and the Rebbe was devastated. On Shabbos, you would never have known it. It was like nothing had happened. After Shabbos, he looked like a mourner. I mean, I remember it very distinctly, very vividly, very really. So this holy man lost a child, and as long as it was Shabbos, he was in the best of spirits, leading his congregation and doing all the things that he normally did and so forth. As soon as he made Abdullah, he burst into tears and he sobbed and he cried and he cried and he cried. And the Hasidim felt that he was crying excessively. In other words, that it didn't make sense to them, based on how they knew him, that he should cry so much at the loss of a child, which is, let's not even go there. So one of the Hasidim said, Rebbe, it seems to us that you're crying beyond what we would anticipate. From you, considering the loss, he says, I'm crying because I realize that it bothers me more that it was my child than if it was somebody else's. He wasn't crying about the loss of his child. He was crying about what he viewed in his world as a selfishness. How dare I feel worse about losing my kid than somebody else's? Now, we're not that Hasidic master. But there's a relevance to the story. There's a depth to the story. V'yahavta l'reiach kamecha, love thy fellow as love thyself, is unconditional love. A Jew is supposed to love every other Jew. And the Tanya discusses this question. How can you love somebody else like you love yourself? It's completely unnatural and frankly practically impossible. And the answer that the Alter Rebbe provides is that on the soul level, we're brothers. On the spiritual level, there's an inner unity. In other words, he says, when you're loving somebody else, you're loving an extension of yourself. How do you make that practical? How do you love everybody else like you love? You know, it's we can all afford to love the Jews in Europe and in Australia as long as they stay there. You know, it's the Jews in our neighborhood, the Jews in my children's class, and that's where I got the problem. My competitors, you know, to love a fellow Jew, it's a serious commandment. It's a very, very serious commandment. And what lies at the heart of it is the argument: you are a spiritual being. How can God expect us to do something which is practically impossible? And the answer is, if God gave us the commandment, that's the proof that it's practical. How is loving another human being practical? We all know it isn't. And the answer is, because I am a spiritual being, and on a spiritual level there's unity. I can love another person, I can love myself, if I am a spiritual person. And the arguments, or the suggestions, the practical side of this, in the Tanya, you read the Tanya and discusses love. It's one of the most important chapters, chapter 32. And in Hebrew, it's lev, which means the heart. The position that the Alter Rebbe gives is, this is a very big challenge to us Americans. The more we, as human beings, de-emphasize our identity as material beings, and the more we emphasize our identity as spiritual beings, the more realistic this is. In other words, our physical selves is what separates us from another physical person. We live in the real world. We must partake of the physical world. We need material things. But when we somehow create in ourselves a perspective where this is very important, but it's only materialism, we permit ourselves to be a little bit more spiritual. And the more we allow ourselves to be spiritual, the fewer separations there are between ourselves and somebody else. Very interesting thing. This morning I got a call from someone from Europe that I know. Interesting girl. She just lost her mother, so she's going through some difficulties. So she called me at 6 o'clock in the morning. That's lunch in Sweden. So that's the story. Anyway, I woke up late. I'll tell you the story another time. So she's very secular. She's not religious at all. But she has an incredible Yiddish neshama. She's totally frum and not frum at all. I mean, practically she doesn't do anything. But she's a very successful woman. She's made it materially. And she sits and talks about secularism. And I'm thinking to myself, lady, you're secular. But she doesn't see herself as secular at all. And she articulates in her own personal life the bankruptcy of secularism. And I don't want to go into the whole conversation, but part of what we discussed was that secular is secular. In America especially, things are very, very important. Materialism, having, you know. The code word amongst the social revolutionaries is consumerism. Remember in high school? They talked about the age of consumerism. Consumerism means, if I can afford it, I'm going to have it, even though I don't need it. Consumerism means we take more than we give, which is inefficient and unsustainable. You know, the whole thing about recycling and ecology. And consumerism is the 20th century. Thank God for the problems that we have. We're all consumers. And so we had this conversation, and she's explaining to me the ills of being secular and the ills of being preoccupied with consumerism. In other words, we really are spiritual beings, And we really can't afford not to be spiritual beings, because we're smaller, we're diminished, we're less if we allow ourselves to be completely preoccupied with material things. And one last thought, I'm going to finish the class, just one last thought I want to share. Another very, very important symptom of the soul is faith. And there's a very powerful message in that. And the message is, Judaism believes that you don't make believers. You uncover belief. Judaism argues that you cannot create believers. If somebody doesn't believe, you can't make them a believer. Because true faith is not based on proof. In other words, we live in a very sophisticated time, and religion is terribly challenged. But the phrase, a leap of faith, was originally introduced by somebody who was finding a fault. A leap of faith is me to say, you're smart, 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 stupid. Smart, 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 smart. That's how the idea is understood. Like a quantum, a missing piece. You know, you can believe as long as you don't have to explain this detail. But a leap of faith is a positive, it's a truth. A leap of faith is the truth, because if I practice all of mitzvahs, I study all the Torah, because intellectually I have rationalized that there is a God, and that God created the world, and that God descended on Mount Sinai and gave us the Torah, I have no relationship with God. I have a relationship with my ego and my mind. I am my own God. My mind justifies my lifestyle. Truly being religious, you know, we're talking about Abraham and the Parshas Shavuah, is jumping. With all the proofs and all the rationalizations, in the end, I have a relationship with God because I surrender. Because I leap. Because I, for a moment, don't rationalize and allow myself to have a connection to something which is beyond. And the basis for this position is the argument that says faith is inherent. You don't create believers. You, if you don't mind, you allow faith to emerge. I'll finish with a story, and then that young lady was a student of mine many years ago, and she still intimidates me. It's okay. Velvel Green, I'll make the story quick, I don't want to keep you here. Velvel Green is a real professor, a smart, smart man, involved in biology and physics. He's if you see the Living Torah, you've seen him interviewed. He grew up in a Yiddish-speaking home where there was no God, period. The Yiddishist movement, I hate to say it, may it rest in peace, was a very, very powerful cultural form of Jews. Many, many Jews, very secular, were very involved in Yiddish culture, Yiddish language, Yiddish art, Yiddish theater, Yiddish culture, Yiddish song and dance. It was a whole world that existed. The foreword is what's left over from that Yiddish culture, from that golden age of Yiddish culture. So Velvel Green's parents were Yiddishists, but they didn't fast Yom Kippur. Nothing. He met Rabbi Feller in the early 1960s, the Rebbe Shliach in Minnesota, and he got involved with Lubavitch. Long story. Very, very long story. But I'm just going to tell you this one little episode. He's a scientist. And as a scientist, he has a certain discipline. You know, he approaches things from a certain angle. And he read a letter from the Rebbe, where the Rebbe was defending the Jewish posture about the age of the universe. You know, according to Jews, the world is 5,771 years old. And of course, scientists are somewhere between 14 and 15 billion. The earth alone is 4 billion years old. This is a considerable discrepancy. They're off by a few days. And so he read this letter where the Rebbe defends, argues, Rebbe had a lot of background in science, argues, in quotes, scientifically, that what says in the Torah is not disputed by science, scientific fact. There are a number of such letters. Another letter is about the question of geocentrism versus heliocentrism. The Rebbe is a literalist. You know? And he gets very upset. He got very, very angry. To him, it seemed irrational. And he told Rabbi Feller, what kind of letter is this? No, he's a scientist, he knows the material, and this doesn't make any sense. So Rabbi Feller told him, ask the Rebbe. They had a very special relationship. In the 1960s, anybody could have had a special relationship with the Rebbe. Velvel Green certainly could have sat in the Rebbe's room for hours and discussed it. So he said to Rabbi Feller, I feel that's a waste of time. The Rebbe doesn't understand the material. It's not his discipline. It's not his specialty. And the Rebbe says, no, the Rebbe has a background in the sciences. Anyway, it took a long time. The Rebbe convinced him. He wrote the Rebbe a letter in which he outlined his objections to the Rebbe's letter. Didn't get an answer. There's only one way he understood that. That he didn't have any answers. You have a question, I want the answer. Instead of saying, I don't know, just lose the letter. And that's how it stayed for a period of several years. Then he was in New York. He was in the Rebbe's room. The Rebbe opened up a drawer, pulled out his letter and read it and answered his questions point by point and showed him that that simplistic letter was sound scientifically. And the Rebbe made quite an impression on him. So he says to the Rebbe, I don't understand you. He says, Rabbi, the questions now are irrelevant to me. In other words, in terms of my spiritual growth, I don't care about those questions. When I asked you the letter, the questions, I was angry. Why didn't you answer me then? And the Rebbe told him these words. He says, had I answered you then, I would have won an argument and lost a Jew. I'd much rather lose an argument and win a Jew. Okay. So this is the topic for tonight. And it's a challenge. It's a challenge to every one of us. And you know what else? It's a constant challenge. You never get comfortable with the soul. Every day it's another thing. It's like you need a cup of coffee in the morning. You got to recharge. Okay. Good night.